and lived. The numbers of these pipes, for example, tell us something about the frequency and types of tobacco use among the classes of society from high, a finger tap on the lid of the enamelled snuff box, to low. The finger moved to stroke the long, straight pipe stem with affectionate familiarity. Now a middle-aged woman, scribbling frantically to catch every word, hardly aware of the singular regard upon her. The lines creased beside smiling hazel eyes.
"You needn't take down everything, Miss Smith," he chided.
"It's an hour's lecture, after all. Your pencil will never last." The woman blushed and dropped her pencil, but smiled shyly in answer to the friendly grin on Frank's lean, dark face. He had them now, everyone warmed by the glow of good humour, attention attracted by the small flashes of guilt and glitter. Now they would follow him without flagging or complaint along the path of logic and into the thickets of discussion. A certain tenseness left his neck as he felt the student's attention settle and fix on him.
"The best witness to history is the man, or woman," a nod to the pretty blonde, "who's lived it, right?"
He smiled and picked up the cracked horn spoon.
"Well, perhaps. After all, it's human nature to put the best face on things when you know someone will read what you've written. People tend to concentrate on the things they think important, and often enough, they tidy it up a bit for public consumption. It's rare to find a Pepys who records with equal interest the details of a royal procession and the number of times each night that he's obliged to use his chamber pot."
The laugh this time was general, and he relaxed, leaning casually back against the table, gesturing with the spoon.
"Similarly, the lovely objects, the artful artifacts, are the ones most often preserved. But the chamber pots and the spoons and the cheap clay pipes can tell us as much or more about the people who use them." "And what about those people? We think of historical persons as something different than ourselves, sometimes halfway mythological. But someone played games with this."
The slender index finger stroked the counterbox.
"A lady used this,"
nudged the scent bottle,
"dabbing scent behind her ears, on her wrists. Where else do you ladies dab scent?"
Lifting his head suddenly, he smiled at the plump blonde girl in the front row, who blushed, giggled, and touched herself demurely just above the V of her blouse.
"Ah, yes, just there. Well, so did the lady who owned this."
Still smiling at the girl, he unstoppered the scent bottle and passed it gently under his nose.
"What is it, Professor? Arpège?"
Not so shy, this student, dark-haired like Frank, with grey eyes that held more than a hint of flirtation.
He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply, nostrils flaring over the mouth of the bottle.
"No, it's l'heure bleue, my favourite."
He turned back to the table, hair falling over his brow in concentration as his hand hovered over the row of miniatures.
"And then there's a special class of objects, portraits. A bit of art, and at the same time, as much as we can see of the people themselves. But how real are they to us?"
He lifted a tiny oval and turned it to face the class, reading from the small gummed label affixed to its back.
"A Lady, by Nathaniel Plimmer, signed with initials and dated 1786, with curled brown hair piled high, wearing a pink dress and a ruffle-collared chemise, cloud and sky background."
He held up a square beside it.
"A Gentleman, by Horace Hone, signed with monogram and dated 1780, with powdered hair en queue, wearing a brown coat, blue waistcoat, lawn jabot, and an order, possibly the most honourable order of the Bath."
The miniature showed a round-faced man, mouth rosily pursed in the formal pose of 18th-century portraits.
"The artists we know," he said,
laying the portrait down,
They signed their work, or they left clues to their identity in the techniques and the subjects they used. But the people they painted? We see them, and yet we know nothing of them. The strange hairstyles, the odd clothes. They don't seem people that you'd know, do they? And the way so many artists painted them, the faces are all alike, pudding-faced and pale, most of them, and not a lot more you can say about them. Here and there, one stands out.
Hand hovering over the row, he selected another oval.
A gentleman.
He held up the miniature, and Jamie's blue eyes blazed out under the fiery thatch of his hair, combed for once, braided and ribboned into an unaccustomed formal order. The knife-edged nose was bold above the lace of his stock, and the long mouth seemed about to speak, half-curled at one corner.
But they were real people,
Frank's voice insisted.
They did much the same things you do, give or take a few small details like going to the pictures or driving down the motorway.
There were appreciative titters amongst the class.
But they cared about their children, they loved their husbands or wives. Well, sometimes they did.
More laughter.
A lady,
he said softly, cradling the last of the portraits in his palm, shielding it for the moment.
With brown hair curling luxuriantly to her shoulders, and a necklace of pearls. Undated, the artist unknown.
It was a mirror, not a miniature. My cheeks were flushed and my lips trembled as Frank's finger gently traced the edge of my jaw, the graceful line of my neck. The tears welled in my eyes and spilled down my cheeks as I heard his voice still lecturing as he laid down the miniature, and I stared upward at the timbered ceiling.
Undated, unknown, but once she was real.
I was having trouble breathing, and thought at first that I was being smothered by the glass over the miniature. But the material pressing on my nose was soft and damp, and I twisted my head away and came awake, feeling the linen pillow wet with tears beneath my cheek. Jamie's hand was large and warm on my shoulder, gently shaking me.
Hush, lassie, hush. You're but dreaming. I'm here.
I turned my face into the warmth of his naked shoulder, feeling the tears slick between cheek and skin. I clung tightly to his solidness, and the small night sounds of the Paris house came slowly to my ears, bringing me back to the life that was mine. I'm sorry, I whispered. I was dreaming about... He patted my back and reached under the pillow for a handkerchief.
I know. You were calling his name.
He sounded resigned. I laid my head back on his shoulder. He smelled warm and rumpled, his own sleepy scent blending with the smell of the down-filled quilt and the clean linen sheets. I'm sorry, I said again. He snorted briefly, not quite a laugh.
Well, I'll see I'm not wicked jealous of the man, he said ruefully, because I am. But I can hardly grudge him your dreams or your tears.
His finger gently traced the wet track down one cheek and then blotted it with the handkerchief. You don't? His smile in the dimness was lopsided.
No. You loved him. I cannot hold it against either of you that you mourn him. And it gives me some comfort to know...
He hesitated, and I reached up to smooth the rumpled hair off his face.
To know what?
That should the need come, you might mourn for me that way,
he said softly. I pressed my face fiercely into his chest so my words were muffled.
I won't mourn you because I won't have to.
I won't lose you. I won't. A thought struck me, and I looked up at him, the faint roughness of his beard stubble a shadow on his face. You aren't afraid I would go back, are you? You don't think that because I think of Frank?
No.
His voice was quick and soft, a response fast as the possessive tightening of his arms around me.
No,
he said again, more softly.
We are bound, you and I, and nothing on this earth shall part me from you.
One large hand rose to stroke my hair.
Do you mind the blood vow that I swore you when we wed?
Yes, I think so. Blood of my blood, bone of my bone.
I give you my body, that we may be one,
he finished.
Aye, and I've kept that vow, Sasnach, and so have you.
He turned me slightly, and one hand cupped itself gently over the tiny swell of my stomach.
Blood of my blood, he whispered, and bone of my bone. You carry me within you, Claire, and you canna leave me now, no matter what happens. You are mine, always, if you will it or no, if you want me or nay. Mine, and I will na let you go.
I put a hand over his, pressing it against me. No, I said softly, nor can you leave me.
No,
he said, half smiling,
for I have kept the last of the vow as well.
He clasped both hands about me and bowed his head on my shoulder so I could feel the warm breath of the words upon my ear, whispered to the dark.
For I give you my spirit, till our life shall be done.
Chapter 11 Useful Occupations. Who is that peculiar little man? I asked Jamie curiously. The man in question was making his way slowly through the groups of guests gathered in the main salon of the de Rohan's house. He would pause a moment, scanning the group with a critical eye, then either shrug a bony shoulder and pass on, or suddenly step in close to a man or woman, hold something to their face, and issue some sort of command. Whatever he was doing, his actions appeared to be the occasion of considerable hilarity. Before Jamie could answer, the man, a small wizened specimen in grey serge, spotted us, and his face lit up. He swooped down on Jamie like a tiny bird of prey, suddenly descending upon a large and startled rabbit. Sing, he commanded.
Eh?
Jamie blinked down at the little figure in astonishment. I said, sing, answered the man patiently. He prodded Jamie admiringly in the chest.
With a resonating cavity like that, you should have a wonderful volume.
Oh, he has volume, I said, amused. You can hear him across three squares of the city when he's roused. Jamie shot me a dirty look. The little man was circling him, measuring the breadth of his back, and tapping on him like a woodpecker sampling a prime tree.
I can't sing, he protested. Nonsense, nonsense, of course you can. A nice deep baritone, too, the little man murmured approvingly. Excellent, just what we need. Here, a bit of help for you. Try to match this tone.
Deftly whipping a small tuning fork from his pocket, he struck it smartly against a pillar and held it next to Jamie's left ear. Jamie rolled his eyes heavenward, but shrugged and obligingly sang a note. The little man jerked back as though he'd been shot.
No,
he said disbelievingly.
I'm afraid so,
I said sympathetically. He's right, you know. He really can't sing. The little man squinted accusingly at Jamie, then struck his fork once more and held it out invitingly.
Once more, he coaxed. Just listen to it and let the same sound come out.
Patient as ever, Jamie listened carefully to the A of the fork and sang again, producing a sound wedged somewhere in the crack between E-flat and D-sharp.
Not possible, said the little man, looking thoroughly disillusioned. No one could be that dissonant, even on purpose.
I can, said Jamie cheerfully, and bowed politely to the little man. We had by now begun to collect a small crowd of interested onlookers. Louise de Rouen was a great hostess, and her salons attracted the cream of Parisian society.
Yes, he can, I assured our visitor. He's tone-deaf, you see.
Yes, I do see, the little man said, looking thoroughly depressed. Then he began to eye me speculatively.
Not me, I said, laughing.
You surely aren't tone-deaf as well, madame?
Eyes glittering like a snake slithering toward a paralyzed bird, the little man began to move toward me, tuning fork twitching like the flicking tongue of a viper.
Wait a minute, I said, holding out a repressive hand. Just who are you?
This is Herr Johannes Gerstmann-Sasnach.
Looking amused, Jamie bowed again to the little man.
The king's singing master. May I present you to my wife, Lady Broch-Turach, Herr Gerstmann.
Trust Jamie to know every last member of the court, no matter how insignificant.
Johannes Gerstmann.
Well, that accounted for the faint accent I had detected under the formality of court French. German, I wondered, or Austrian?
I'm assembling a small impromptu chorus, the little singing master explained. The voices need not be trained, but they must be strong and true.
He cast a glance of disillusionment at Jamie, who merely grinned in response. He took the tuning fork from Herr Gerstmann and held it inquiringly in my direction.
Oh, all right, I said, and sang.
Whatever he heard appeared to encourage Herr Gerstmann, for he put away the tuning fork and peered at me interestedly. His wig was a trifle too big and tended to slide forward when he nodded. He did so now, then pushed the wig carelessly back and said,
"Excellent tone, madame. Really very nice indeed. Are you acquainted, perhaps, with Le Papillon?"
He hummed a few bars.
"Well, I've heard it, at least," I replied cautiously. "The melody, I mean. I don't know the words."
"Ah, no difficulty, madame. The chorus is simplicity, like this." My arm trapped in the singing master's grip, I found myself being ineluctably drawn away toward the sound of harpsichord music in a distant room, Herr Gerstmann humming in my ear like a demented bumblebee. I cast a helpless glance back at Jamie, who merely grinned and raised his cup of sorbet in a farewell salute, before turning to take up a conversation with Monsieur Duvernay, the younger, the son of the Minister of Finance. The Rouen's house, if you could use a mere word like house in description of such a place, was alight with lanterns strung through the back garden and edging the terrace. As Herr Gerstmann towed me through the corridors, I could see servants hurrying in and out of the supper rooms, laying linen and silver for the dining that would take place later. Most salons were small, intimate affairs, but the Princess Louise de la Tour de Rouen was an expansive personality. I had met the Princess a week before, at another evening party, and had found her something of a surprise. Plump and rather plain, she had a round face with a small round chin, pale lashless blue eyes, and a star-shaped false beauty mark that did very little to fulfil its function in life. So this was the lady who enticed Prince Charles into ignoring the dictates of propriety, I thought, curtsying in the receiving line. Still, she had an air of lively animation about her that was quite attractive, and a lovely soft pink mouth. Her mouth was the most animated part of her, in fact.
"But I'm charmed," she had exclaimed, grabbing my hand as I was presented to her.
"How wonderful to meet you at last. My husband and my father have both sung the praises of Milord Broch-Turach unendingly, but of his delightful wife they have said nothing.
I am enchanted beyond measure by your coming, my dear sweet lady. Must I really say Broch-Turach,
Or won't it do if I only say Lady Turoch? I'm not sure I could remember all of it, but one would, surely, even if such a strange-sounding word... Is it Scottish?
How enchanting! In fact, Broch Turoch meant the north-facing tower.
But if she wanted to call me Lady North-Facing, it was all right with me.
In the event, she quickly gave up trying to remember Turoch, and had since called me only Ma Chère Claire.
Louise herself was with the group of singers in the music room, fluttering plumply from one to another, talking and laughing. When she saw me, she dashed across the room as fast as her draperies would allow, her plain face alight with animation.
"Ma chère Claire," she exclaimed,
ruthlessly commandeering me from Herr Gerstmann.
"You are just in time. Come, you must talk to this silly English child for me."
The silly English child was, in fact, very young. A girl of not more than 15, with dark, shiny ringlets, and cheeks flushed so hotly with embarrassment that she reminded me of a brilliant poppy. In fact, it was the cheeks that recalled her to me, the girl I had glimpsed in the garden at Versailles, just before the unsettling appearance of Alexander Randall.
"Madame Fraser is English too," Louise was explaining to the girl. "She will soon make you feel at home."
"She's shy," Louise explained, turning to me without pausing to draw breath. "Talk to her. Persuade her to sing with us. She has a delightful voice, I am assured. There, mes enfants, enjoy yourselves." And with a pat of benediction, she was off to the other side of the room, exclaiming, cajoling, marvelling at a new arrival's gown, pausing to fondle the overweight youth who sat at the harpsichord, twisting ringlets of his hair around her finger as she chattered to the Duke di Castellotti.
"Makes you rather tired just to watch her, doesn't it?" I said in English, smiling at the girl.
A tiny smile appeared on her own lips, and she bobbed her head briefly, but didn't speak.
I thought this must all be rather overwhelming. Louise's parties tended to make my own head spin, and the little poppy girl could scarcely be out of the schoolroom.
"I'm Claire Fraser," I said, "but Louise didn't remember to tell me your name." I paused invitingly, but she didn't reply. Her face got redder and redder, lips pressed tight together, and her fists clenched at her sides. I was a trifle alarmed at her appearance, but she finally summoned the will to speak. She took a deep breath, and raised her chin like one about to mount the scaffold.
"My name is..." she began,
and at once I understood her silence and her painful shyness. She closed her eyes, biting her lips savagely, then opened her eyes and gamely had another try.
"Mary Hawkins," she managed at last. "Don't sing," she added defiantly.
If I had found her interesting before, I was fascinated now. So this was Silas Hawkins' niece, the baronet's daughter, the intended fiancée of the Vicomte Marigny. It seemed a considerable weight of male expectation for such a young girl to bear. I glanced around to see whether the Vicomte was in evidence, and was relieved to find that he wasn't. "Don't worry about it," I said, stepping in front of her to shield her from the waves of people now filling the music room. "You needn't talk if you don't want to.
Though perhaps you should try to sing," I said, struck by a thought.
I knew a physician once who specialised in the treatment of stammering. He said that people who stammer don't do it when they sing.
Mary Hawkins' eyes grew wide with astonishment at this. I looked around and saw a nearby alcove, curtained to hide a cosy bench.
"Here," I said, taking her by the hand. "You can sit in here so you don't have to talk to people. If you want to sing, you can come out when we start. If not, just stay in here till the party's over."
She stared at me for a minute, then gave me a sudden, blinding smile of gratitude.
and ducked into the alcove. I loitered outside to prevent any nosy servants from disturbing her hiding place, chatting with passers-by.
"How lovely you look tonight, ma chère."
It was Madame de Romage, one of the Queen's ladies. An older, dignified woman, she had come to supper in the Rue Trimoulin once or twice. She embraced me warmly, then looked around to be sure that we were unobserved.
"I had hoped to see you here, my dear," she said,
leaning a bit closer and lowering her voice.
"I wish to advise you to take care concerning the Comte Saint-Germain."
Half turning in the direction of her gaze, I saw the lean-faced man from the docks of Le Havre entering the music room with a younger, elegantly dressed woman on his arm. He hadn't seen me, apparently, and I hastily turned back to Madame de Romage.
"What? Has he... I mean..."
I could feel myself flushing still more deeply, rattled by the appearance of the saturnine Comte.
"Well, yes, he has been heard to speak of you," Madame de Romage said, kindly helping me out of my confusion. "I gather that there was some small difficulty in love."
"Something of the kind," I said. "All I did was to recognize a case of smallpox, but it resulted in the destruction of his ship, and he wasn't pleased about it," I concluded weakly.
"Ah, so that was it."
Madame de Romage looked pleased. I imagined having the inside story, so to speak, would give her an advantage in the trade of gossip and information that was the commerce of Parisian social life.
"He has been going about telling people that he believes you to be a witch," she said, smiling and waving at a friend across the room. "A fine story." "Oh, no one believes it," she assured me. "Everyone knows that if anyone is mixed up in such matters, it is Monsieur le Comte himself."
"Really?" I wanted to ask just what she meant by this, but just then Herr Gerstmann bustled up, clapping his hands as though shooing a flock of hens.
"Come, come, mesdames," he said. "We are all complete. The singing commences."
As the chorale hastily assembled near the harpsichord, I looked back toward the alcove where I had left Mary Hawkins. I thought I saw the curtain twitch, but wasn't sure. And as the music began and the joined voices rose, I thought I heard a clear high soprano from the direction of the alcove. But again, I wasn't sure.
"Very nice, Sassenach,"
Jamie said when I rejoined him, flushed and breathless after the singing. He grinned down at me and patted my shoulder. "How would you know?" I said, accepting a glass of wine punch from a passing servant. "You can't tell one song from another."
"Well, you were loud anyway," he said, unperturbed. "I could hear every word."
I felt him stiffen slightly beside me and turned to see what, or whom, he was looking at. The woman who had just entered was tiny, scarcely as high as Jamie's lowest rib, with hands and feet like a doll's, and brows delicate as Chinese tracery, over eyes the deep black of sloes. She advanced with a step that mocked its own lightness, so she looked as though she were dancing just above the ground. "There's Annalise de Marillac," I said, admiring her. "Doesn't she look lovely?"
"Why?"
Something in his voice made me glance sharply upward. A faint pink tinged the tips of his ears. "And here I thought you spent your years in France fighting, not making romantic conquests," I said tartly. To my surprise, he laughed at this. Catching the sound, the woman turned toward us. A brilliant smile lit her face as she saw Jamie looming among the crowd. She turned as though to come in our direction, but was distracted by a gentleman wigged and resplendent in lavender satin, who laid an importuning hand on her fragile arm. She flicked her fan charmingly at Jamie in a gesture of regretful coquetry, before devoting her attention to her new companion. "What's so funny?" I asked, seeing him still grinning broadly after the lady's gently oscillating lace skirts. He snapped suddenly back to an awareness of my presence and smiled down at me.
"Oh, nothing, Sassenach. Only what you said about fighting. I fought my first duel, well, the only one, in fact, over Annelies de Marillac, when I was 18.
His tone was mildly dreamy, watching the sleek, dark head bob away through the crowd, surrounded, wherever it went, by white clusters of wigs and powdered hair, with here and there a fashionably pink-tinged peruke for variety.
"A duel?
With whom?" I asked, glancing round warily for any male attachments to the china doll who might feel inclined to follow up an old quarrel.
"Oh, he isn't here,"
Jamie said, catching and correctly interpreting my glance.
"He's dead."
"You killed him?" Agitated, I spoke rather louder than intended. As a few nearby heads turned curiously in our direction, Jamie took me by the elbow and steered me hastily toward the nearest French doors.
"Mind your voice, Sassenach,"
he said, mildly enough.
"No, I didn't kill him. Wanted to," he added ruefully, "but didn't. He died 2 years ago of the morbid sore throat, Jared told me."
He guided me down one of the garden paths, lit by lantern-bearing servants, who stood like bollards at five-yard intervals from the terrace to the fountain at the bottom of the path. In the midst of a big reflecting pool, four dolphins sprayed sheets of water over an annoyed-looking triton in the centre, who brandished a trident rather ineffectually at them.
"Well, don't keep me in suspense,"
I urged as we passed out of hearing of the groups on the terrace. "What happened?"
"All right, then,"
he said, resigned.
"Well, you will have observed that Annelies is rather pretty."
"Oh, really? Well, perhaps now you mention it, I can see something of the kind," I answered sweetly, provoking a sudden sharp look, followed by a lopsided smile.
"Aye. Well, I wasn't the only young gallant in Paris to be of the same opinion, nor the only one to lose his head over her, either. Went about in a daze, tripping over my feet. Waited in the street in hopes of seeing her come out of her house to the carriage. Forgot to eat, even. Jared said my coat hung on me like a scarecrow's, and the state of my hair didn't much help the resemblance."
His hand went absently to his head, patting the immaculate queue that lay clubbed tight against his neck, bound with blue ribbon.
"Forgot to eat? Christ, you did have it bad," I remarked.
He chuckled.
"Oh, aye. And still worse, when she began to flirt with Charles Gauloise."
"Mind you," he added fairly, "she flirted with everyone. That was all right. But she chose him for a supper partner hour often for my taste, and danced with him too much at the parties, and... well... the long and the short of it, Sassenach, is that I caught him kissing her in the moonlight on her father's terrace one night, and challenged him."
By this time we had reached the fountain in our promenade. Jamie drew to a stop, and we sat on the rim of the fountain, upwind of the spray from the puff-lipped dolphins. Jamie drew a hand through the dark water and lifted it, dripping, abstractedly watching the silver drops run down his fingers.
"Dueling was illegal in Paris then, as it is now. But there were places, there always are. It was his to choose, and he picked a spot in the Bois de Boulogne, close by the road of the Seven Saints, but hidden by a screen of oaks. The choice of weapon was his too. I expected pistols, but he chose swords."
"Why would he do that? You must have had a 6-inch reach on him, or more." I was no expert, was perforce learning a small bit about the strategy and tactics of sword fighting. Jamie and Murtaugh took each other on every 2 or 3 days to keep in practice, clashing and parrying and lunging up and down the garden, to the untrammelled delight of the servants, male and female alike, who all surged out onto the balconies to watch.
Why did he choose small swords?
Because he was bloody good with one.
Also, I suspected he thought I might kill him accidentally with a pistol, while he knew I'd be satisfied only to draw blood with a blade.
I didn't mean to kill him, you ken, he explained, only to humiliate him.
And he knew it.
No fool was our Charles, he said, ruefully shaking his head.
The mist from the fountain was making ringlets escape from my coiffure to curl around my face. I brushed back a wisp of hair, asking,
"And did you humiliate him?"
"Well, I wounded him, at least."
I was surprised to hear a small note of satisfaction in his voice, and raised an eyebrow at him.
"He learned his craft from Le Jeune, one of the best sword masters in France," Jamie exclaimed. "Like fighting a damn flea it was, and I fought him right-handed too."
He pushed a hand through his hair once more, as though checking the binding.
"My hair came loose, midway through," he said. "The thong holding it broke, and the wind was blowing it into my eyes, so all I could see was the wee white shape of Charles in his shirt, darting to and fro like a minnow. And that's how I got him, finally, the way you'd spear a fish with a dirk."
He snorted through his nose.
"He let out a skellock as though I'd run him through, though I knew I'd but pinked him in one arm. I got the hair out of my face at last and looked beyond him to see Annalise standing there at the edge of the clearing with her eyes wide and dark as yon pool."
He gestured out over the silver-black surface beside us.
"So I sheathed my blade, smoothed back my hair and stood there, half expecting her to come and throw herself into my arms, I suppose.
I said delicately, "I gather she didn't?"
"Well, I didn't ken anything about women then, did I?" he demanded. "No, she came and threw herself on him, of course."
He made a Scottish noise deep in his throat, one of self-derision and humorous disgust.
"Married him a month later, I heard."
"I will."
He shrugged suddenly with a rueful smile.
"So my heart was broken. Went home to Scotland and moped about for weeks until my father lost patience with me."
He laughed.
"I even thought of turning monk over it. Said to my father over supper one night, as I thought perhaps in the spring I'd go across to the abbey and become a novice."
I laughed at the thought.
"Well, you'd have no difficulty with the vow of poverty. Chastity and obedience might come a bit harder."
"What did your father say?" He grinned, teeth white in a dark face.
"He was eating brose. He laid down the spoon and looked at me for a moment. And he sighed and shook his head and said, 'It's been a long day, Jamie.' And he picked up the spoon again and went back to his supper. And I never said another word about it."
He looked up the slope to the terrace, where those not dancing strolled to and fro, cooling off between dances, sipping wine and flirting behind fans. He sighed nostalgically.
"Aye, a very pretty lass, Annalise de Marillac, graceful as the wind, and so small that you wanted to tuck her inside your shirt and carry her like a kitten."
I was silent, listening to the faint music from the open doors above as I contemplated the gleaming satin slipper that encased my size 9 foot. After a moment, Jamie became aware of my silence.
"What is it, Sassnach?"
he asked, laying a hand on my arm.
"Oh, nothing," I said with a sigh. "Only thinking that I rather doubt anyone will ever describe me as graceful as the wind."
"Ah."
His head was half turned, the long straight nose and firm chin lighted from behind by the glow of the nearest lantern. I could see the half-smile on his lips as he turned back toward me.
"Well, I'll tell you, Sassnach. Graceful is possibly not the first word that springs to mind at the thought of you."
He slipped an arm behind me, one hand large and warm around my silk-clad shoulder.
"But I talk to you as I talk to my own soul," he said,
turning me to face him. He reached up and cupped my cheek, fingers light on my temple.
"Anne Sassnach,"
he whispered,
"your face is my heart."
It was the shifting of the wind several minutes later that parted us at last with a fine spray from the fountain. We broke apart and rose hastily, laughing at the sudden chill of the water. Jamie inclined his head inquiringly toward the terrace, and I took his arm, nodding.
"So," I observed as we made our way slowly up the wide steps to the ballroom, "you've learned a bit more about women now, I see."
He laughed, low and deep, tightening his grasp on my waist.
"The most important thing I've learned about women, Sassnach, is which one to choose."
He stepped away, bowing to me, and gesturing through the open doors to the brilliant scene inside.
"May I have this dance, m'lady?"
I spent the next afternoon at the Dabonvies, where I met the king's singing master once again. This time we found time for a conversation, which I recounted to Jamie after supper.
"You what?"
Jamie squinted at me as though he suspected me of pulling some practical joke. I said, "Herr Gerstmann suggested that I might be interested in meeting a friend of his. Mother Hildegard is in charge of L'Hôpital des Anges, you know, the charity hospital down near the cathedral."
"I know where it is."
His voice was marked by a general lack of enthusiasm. He had a sore throat, and that led me to telling him what to take for it, and a bit about medicines in general, and how I was interested in diseases, and, well, you know how one thing leads to another.
"With you, it customarily does," he agreed, sounding distinctly cynical.
I ignored his tone and went on.
"So,
I'm going to go to the hospital tomorrow." I stretched on tiptoe to reach down my medicine box from its shelf. "Maybe I won't take it along with me the first time," I said, scanning the contents meditatively. "Might seem too pushing. Do you think?"
"Pushing?"
He sounded stunned.
"Are you meaning to visit the place or move into it?"
Well, I said. I took a deep breath. I thought perhaps I could work there regularly. Herr Gerstmann says that all the physicians and healers who go there donate their time. Most of them don't turn up every day, but I have plenty of time and I could..."
"Plenty of time?"
"Stop repeating everything I say," I said. "Yes, plenty of time. I know it's important to go to salon and supper parties and all that, but it doesn't take all day. At least it needn't. I could..."
"Sassnach, you're with child. You didn't mean to go out to nurse beggars and criminals."
He sounded rather helpless now, as though wondering how to deal with someone who had suddenly gone mad in front of him. "I hadn't forgotten," I assured him. I pressed my hands against my belly, squinting down. "It isn't really noticeable yet. With a loose gown, I can get away with it for a time. And there's nothing wrong with me except the morning sickness. No reason why I shouldn't work for some months yet."
"No reason. Except I will not have you doing it."
Expecting no company this evening, he had taken off his stock and opened his collar when he came home. I could see the tide of dusky red advancing up his throat. "Jamie," I said, striving for reasonableness, "you know what I am."
"You're my wife."
"Well, that too." I flicked the idea aside with my fingers. "I'm a nurse, Jamie, A healer. You have reason to know it.
He flushed hotly.
Aye, I do. And because you've mended me when I'm wounded, I should think it right for you to tend beggars and prostitutes.
Sassenach, do you know Ken, the sort of people that L'Hôpital des Anges takes in?
He looked pleadingly at me, as though expecting me to return to my senses any minute. What difference does that make? He looked wildly around the room, imploring witness from the portrait over the mantelpiece as to my unreasonableness.
You could catch a filthy disease, for God's sake. Do you have no regard for your child, even if you have none for me?
Reasonableness was seeming a less desirable goal by the moment.
Of course I have. What kind of careless, irresponsible person do you think I am?
The kind who would abandon her husband to go and play with scum in the gutter, he snapped. Since you ask.
He ran a big hand through his hair, making it stick up at the crown. Abandon you? Since when is it abandoning you to suggest really doing something instead of rotting away in the Darbonville salon, watching Louise de Rohan stuff herself with pastry and listening to bad poetry and worse music? I want to be useful.
Taking care of your own household is not useful. Being married to me is not useful.
The lacing round his hair broke under the stress, and the thick locks fluffed out like a flaming halo. He glared down his nose at me like an avenging angel.
Sauce for the gander, I retorted coldly. Is being married to me sufficient occupation for you?
I don't notice you hanging round the house all day, adoring me. And as for the household, bosh.
Bosh? What's bosh?
He demanded. Stuff and nonsense. Rot. Horse feathers. In other words, don't be ridiculous. Madame Vionnet does everything, and does it several dozen times better than I could.
This was so patently true that it stopped him for a moment. He glared down at me, jaw working.
Why? And if I forbid you to go?
This stopped me for a moment. I drew myself up and looked him up and down. His eyes were the colour of rain-dark slate. The wide, generous mouth clamped in a straight line. Shoulders broad and back erect, arms folded across his chest like a cast-iron statue. Forbidding was precisely the word that best described him.
Do you forbid me?
The tension crackled between us. I wanted to blink, but wouldn't give in the satisfaction of breaking off my own steely gaze. What would I do if he forbade me to go? Alternatives raced through my mind. Everything from planting the ivory letter opener between his ribs to burning down the house with him in it. The only idea I rejected absolutely was that of giving in. He paused and drew a deep breath before speaking. His hands were curled into fists at his sides, and he uncurled them with conscious effort.
No, he said. No, I dinna forbid you.
His voice shook slightly with the effort to control it.
But if I asked you...
I looked down then, and stared at his reflection in the polished tabletop. At first, the idea of visiting L'Hôpital des Anges had seemed merely an interesting idea, an attractive alternative to the endless gossip and petty intrigues of Parisian society. But now, I could feel the muscles of my arms swell as I clenched my own fists. I didn't just want to work again. I needed to. I don't know, I said at last. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Will you think about it, Claire?
I could feel his eyes on me. After what seemed a long time, I nodded. I'll think about it.
Good.
His tension broken, he turned restlessly away. He wandered round the drawing room, picking up small objects and putting them down at random, finally coming to roost by the bookshelf, where he leaned, staring unseeingly at the leather-bound titles. I came tentatively up beside him and laid a hand on his arm. "Jamie, I didn't mean to upset you." He glanced down at me and gave me a sidelong smile.
"Aye, well, I didn't mean to fight with you either, Sassenach. I'm short-tempered and now a touchy, I expect."
He patted my hand in apology, then moved aside to stand looking down at his desk. "You've been working hard," I said soothingly, following him.
"That's not that."
He shook his head and reached out to flip open the pages of the huge ledger that lay in the centre of the desk.
"The wine business, that's all right. It's a great deal of work, aye, but I dinna mind it. It's the other."
He gestured at a small stack of letters held down by an alabaster paperweight. One of Jared's, it was carved in the shape of a white rose, the Stuart's emblem. The letters it secured were from Abbot Alexander, from the Earl of Mar, from other prominent Jacobites, all filled with veiled inquiry, misty promises, contradictory expectations.
"I feel as though I'm fighting feathers," Jamie said violently. "A real fight, something I could get my hands on. That I could do. But this..."
He snatched up the handful of letters from the desk and tossed them into the air. The room was draughty, and the papers zigzagged wildly, sliding under furniture and fluttering on the carpet.
"There's nothing to get hold of," he said helplessly. "I can talk to 1,000 people, write 100 letters, drink with Charles till I'm blind and never know if I'm getting on or not."
I let the scattered letters lie. One of the maids could retrieve them later. "Jamie," I said softly, "we can't do anything but try." He smiled faintly, hands braced on the desk.
"Aye, I'm glad you said we, Sassenach. I do feel very much alone with it all sometimes."
I put my arms around his waist and laid my face against his back. "You know I wouldn't leave you alone with it," I said. "I got you into it in the first place, after all." I could feel the small vibration of a laugh under my cheek.
"Aye, you did. I will not hold it against you, Sassenach."
He turned, leaned down, and kissed me lightly on the forehead.
"You look tired, Modunya. Go up to bed now. I've a bit more work to do, but I'll join you soon."
"All right." I was tired tonight, though the chronic sleepiness of early pregnancy was giving way to new energy. I was beginning to feel alert in the daytime, brimming with the urge to be active. I paused at the door on my way out. He was still standing by the desk, staring down into the pages of the open ledger. "Jamie," I said.
"Aye."
"The hospital. I said I'd think about it. You think too, hm?" He turned his head, one brow sharply arched. Then he smiled and nodded briefly.
"I'll come to you soon, Sassenach," he said.
It was still sleeting, and tiny particles of frozen rain rattled against the windows and hissed into the fire when the night wind turned to drive them down the flue. The wind was high, and it moaned and grumbled among the chimneys, making the bedroom seem all the cosier by contrast. The bed itself was an oasis of warmth and comfort, equipped with goose-down quilts, huge fluffy pillows, and Jamie, faithfully putting out British thermal units like an electric storage heater. His large hand stroked lightly across my stomach, warm through the thin silk of my nightdress. "No, there. You have to press a little harder." I took his hand and pressed the fingers downward, just above my pubic bone, where the uterus had begun to make itself obvious, a round, hard swelling, a little larger than a grapefruit.
"Aye, I feel it," he murmured. "He's really there."
a tiny smile of awed delight tucked at the corner of his mouth, and he looked up at me, eyes sparkling.
"Can you feel him move yet?"
I shook my head.
"Not yet.
Another month or so, I think, from what your sister Jenny said."
"Hmm,"
he said, kissing the tiny bulge.
"What do you think of Dalhousie, Sasnach?"
"What do I think of Dalhousie as what?" I inquired.
"Well, as a name," he said.
He patted my stomach.
"He'll need a name."
"True," I said. "Though what makes you think it's a boy? It might just as easily be a girl."
"Oh? Oh, aye, that's true,"
he admitted, as though the possibility had just occurred to him.
"Still, why not start with the boy's names? We could name him for your uncle who raised you."
"Hmm," I frowned at my midsection. Dearly as I had loved my Uncle Lamb, I didn't know that I wanted to inflict either Lambert or Quentin on a helpless infant.
"No, I don't think so.
On the other hand, I don't think I'd want to name him for one of your uncles either." Jamie stroked my stomach absently, thinking.
"What was your father's name, Sasnach?" he asked.
I had to think for a moment to remember. "Henry," I said. "Henry Montmorency Beecham."
"Jamie, I'm not having a child named Montmorency Fraser, no matter what. I'm not so keen on Henry either, though it's better than Lambert."
"How about William," I suggested, "for your brother?" His older brother, William, had died in late childhood, but had lived long enough for Jamie to remember him with great affection. His brow was furrowed in thought.
"Hmm," he said. "Aye, maybe. Or we could call him..."
"James,"
said a hollow, sepulchral voice from the flue.
"What?"
I said, sitting straight up in bed.
"James," said the fireplace impatiently. "James! James!" "Sweet bleeding Jesus," said Jamie, staring at the leaping flames on the hearth.
I could feel the hair standing up on his forearm, stiff as wire. He sat frozen for a moment. Then a thought occurring to him, he jumped to his feet and went to the dormer window, not bothering to put anything on over his shirt. He flung up the sash, admitting a blast of frigid air, and thrust his head out into the night. I heard a muffled shout, and then a scrabbling sound across the slates of the roof. Jamie leaned far out, rising on his toes to reach, then backed slowly into the room, rain dampened, and grunting with effort. He dragged with him, arms clasped about his neck, the form of a handsome boy in dark clothing, thoroughly soaked, with a blood-stained cloth wrapped around one hand. The visitor caught his foot on the sill and landed clumsily, sprawling on the floor. He scrambled up at once, though, and bowed to me, snatching off his slouch hat.
"Madame," he said, in thickly accented French, "I must beg your pardon. I arrive so without ceremony. I intrude, but it is of necessity that I call upon my friend James at such an unsocial hour."
He was a sturdy, good-looking lad, with thick, light brown hair curling loose upon his shoulders, and a fair face, cheeks flushed red with cold and exertion. His nose was running slightly, and he wiped it with the back of his wrapped hand, wincing slightly as he did so. Jamie, both eyebrows raised, bowed politely to the visitor.
"My house is at your service, Your Highness," he said, with a glance that took in the general disorder of the visitor's attire.
His stock was undone, and hung loosely around his neck. Half his buttons were done up awry, and the flies of his breeches flopped partially open. I saw Jamie frown slightly at this, and he moved unobtrusively in front of the boy to screen me from the indelicate sight.
"If I may present my wife, Your Highness," he said. "Claire, my Lady Brochturach. Claire, this is His Highness Prince Charles, son of King James of Scotland." "Yes," I said. "I'd rather gathered that. Good evening, Your Highness."
I nodded graciously, pulling the bedclothes up around me,
I suppose that under the circumstances I could dispense with the usual curtsy. The prince had taken advantage of Jamie's long-winded introduction to fumble his trousers into better order, and now nodded back at me, full of royal dignity. "It is my